and in many ways the sort of black underside of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, man who almost single-handedly put together the largest shipment for U.S. distribution of acid in history, and who, as we saw briefly at the end of the last part of the broadcast, it was also affiliated with more fascists than you could shake a stick at if you had a real big stick. And we're going to discuss a little further Ron Stark's strange bedfellows.
Indeed. And again, remember, this is the largest supplier of underground LSD in the United States. Now, resuming here with our discussion of Ronald Hadley Stark, the manufacturer for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, bankrolled by William Mellon Hitchcock, closely affiliated with Timothy Leary. And for our further information on the career of Ronald Hadley Stark, we're going to deal with an essay we're going to read, actually, almost in its entirety, an essay called The Strange Career of Ronald Hadley Stark. This is authored by Jonathan Marshall, currently the editorial page editor of the Oakland Tribune and one of the principal researchers in this field. And again, his essay is called The Strange Career of Ronald Hadley Stark. Name, Ronald Hadley Stark. Occupation, drug chemist and smuggler. Sidelines, intelligence agent, terrorist. Characteristics, 5'6", 180 pounds, chestnut eyes, born April 30th. In USA, fluent in 9 languages, including Chinese and Arabic, exceptional competence with explosives, FBI number 812020E. And then the rest of the notations, I don't understand. I believe that's his social security number. I'm not going to bother with that. Marshall continues, who was this man? To this day, no one but Stark himself knows for sure. A convicted smuggler, an associate of the highest-ranking Italian terrorists, both left and right, suspected of involvement with the CIA and Italian intelligence. Stark remains an extraordinary international enigma, despite years of investigation by authorities on both sides of the Atlantic. The following account of his life pulls together most of what is publicly known about his career. But first, a word of warning. Stark claims that, quote, 95% of what is written about me is absolutely false, unquote. The paper trail on Stark begins with his first entry in an FBI file on the 24th of September, 1962, for filing a false declaration to gain a U.S. government position. Characteristically, however, the facts of the case, and even whether Stark served time in prison, have been lost, despite later efforts by the DEA to track them down. Stark left the United States for Europe in the late 1960s. He helped set up the British and French ends of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, a pro-drug propaganda and smuggling organization founded by Timothy Leary, which had strong links to the Weathermen. The American end supplied money. The European side manufactured extraordinary quantities of LSD, hundreds of millions of dollars worth, and shipped it illicitly to the U.S. beginning around 1968. In 1969, Stark recruited into his LSD operation one Richard Kemp, a British chemist and, quote, political extremist intent on causing revolution by widespread distribution of LSD to the youth of Britain. Even then, some associates suspected Stark of working for the CIA.
Continuing with Marshall's essay. In November 1971, he opened a research chemistry lab in Belgium, a front for illicit drug manufacturing. His equipment, which cost $300,000, was paid for out of a Swiss account. The lab was closed in October 1974. In 1972 and 1973, he invested $100,000 in two drug factories in California. The umbrella for his operation was a Liechtenstein company called Four Star Establishment, which also owned a ranch in California used by Timothy Leary as a residence. Investigating his case was the U.S. narcotics officer, U.S. narcotics agent Thomas Angioletti. And we'll go back to Angioletti in a second, who reported as early as 1971 that Stark had, quote, opened a laboratory to investigate producing LSD. In 1973, he was indicted in California on drug charges, but no extradition request was ever sent. At the trial, defense attorneys for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love remarked on Stark's multiple identity. They entered a document citing different witnesses who knew Stark previously as a doctor, a chemist, a millionaire, and as a secret agent of the U.S. government. By the way, the U.S. narcotics agent Thomas Angioletti investigating Stark's case, according to Marshall's footnote, Angioletti was the agent who, quote, ran Syrian Guns for Drugs kingpin and Banco Ambrosiano intimate Henri Arsene, Arsene had business dealings with, among others, Sicilian mafia boss Gerlando Alberti and the Red Brigades. We should mention real quickly about Arsene that those of you who did not get to hear the Mediterranean merry-go-round shows known in the RFA archives as the Who Shot the Pope series, that Henri Arsene is a very important person. He headed up the world's largest guns for drugs network known as STIBAM, STIBAM. At the same time, he was being run, as they mention, as a DEA agent. The DEA even helped Arsene to obtain quantities of illicit chemicals for various purposes. Now, STIBAM was intimately connected with the Banco Ambrosiano, the largest Italian private bank, run by Roberto Calvi, who was a member of Licio Gelli's P2 Masonic Lodge Front for a Fascist Government. Roberto Calvi himself, a fascist banker, an intimate of Michele Sindona, another man with connections both to the fascist milieu and also the CIA. And Henri Arsene's operation, STIBAM, operated directly with Banco Ambrosiano and the P2 to further the political aims of the P2's essentially fascist bankers, military men, intelligence officials who had permeated every rank of Italian government. And they ran operations all over the world on behalf of fascist politics, propping up fascist governments, starting fascist insurrections in countries that were governed by non-fascists. And all of this was supported to a large extent by STIBAM's guns and drugs operation. So we have, just by perhaps a strange coincidence, the man investigating Ron Stark for the DEA is also the man who just happened to run Henri Arsene, the Syrian drug lord who was heading up the operation that worked so very closely with the same Italian fascist that Ron Stark just happened to be in close contact with.
Also worked very closely with U.S. intelligence, and there's considerable question as to whether the STIBAM Arms for Drugs ring was involved with the Iran-Contra arms operation. We're going to be talking about that in our Radio Free America series about that. By the way, the information about Angeletti, his relationship with Arsene, and STIBAM's connections not only to the shooting of the Pope but also to American and Western intelligence, we cover that in Radio Free America shows numbers 20 and 25. Continuing with Marshall's essay. Official investigations of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love Network continued in the U.S. and Great Britain into the late 1970s. The American end of this syndicate was eventually discovered to be heavily involved in arms dealings, particularly in British Leopard tanks, a Middle East favorite, and, quote, vast quantities of small arms ammunition, unquote. And by the way, a lot of the footnotes in Marshall's essay are taken from a British book about the Brotherhood of Eternal Love called Operation Julie. It's published, authored by Dick Lee and Colin Pratt, published in London in 1978. That is a book which hopefully we'll be able to get our hands on at some point in the future. And the Operation Julie, by the way, was what the bust breakup of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love was called, named for the British policewoman who infiltrated the organization. But that's where much of Marshall's information comes from. Again, resuming the narrative, the American end of this syndicate was eventually discovered to be heavily involved in arms dealings, particularly in British Leopard tanks, a Middle East favorite, and vast quantities of small arms ammunition. Stark remained in Europe. Between 1972 and 4, he owned a hovel in Florence. He made the acquaintance in that period of Roberto Fiorenzi, an engineer known as Booby, later jailed on charges of aiding the Fiumicino-Rome airport massacre, which left 32 dead in a Palestinian attack on an Israeli plane. By 1974, Stark was in Milan frequenting ultra-left terrorist circles. Stark was arrested on the 15th of February, 1975, in the Grand Hotel Baglioni in Bologna in possession of 4,600 kilos of cannabis, morphine, and cocaine. Police also discovered in a Rome safe deposit box rented by Stark documents on the manufacturing process for LSD. Among the other documents found at the time of his arrest were proofs of his ties to several extraordinary people. The ex-president of Ente Mineriano Siciliano, Graziano Verzato, V-E-R-Z-O-T-T-O, the former Sicilian Christian Democratic leader Salvatore Lima, L-I-M-A, the Black Prince Aliati di Monterreale, and that's M-O-N-T-E-R-E-A-L-E, and the ex-head of the Italian intelligence agency SID, Vito Micheli. Now, on those three individuals, namely Graziani, Verzato, Salvatore Lima, Aliati di Monterreale, and Vito Micheli, Marshall footnotes as follows. On Verzato, full name Graziano Ferzato. Ferzato, a Venetian, got his start as right-hand man to Italian oil magnate Enrico Mattei, M-A-T-T-E-I, whose controversial death, the subject of a film by Francesco Rossi, has been linked variously to Sicilian heroin kingpin Tommaso Buscetta, the CIA, and others in Ente Nazionale Idrocarburi. Ferzato went on to become regional secretary of the Christian Democratic Party with a power base in Syracuse. Then, after Mattei's death, he became a senator and head of EMS. Ferzato appointed the powerful mafioso Giuseppe Di Cristina, a close ally of Buscetta, treasurer of Socimici, S-O-C-H-I-M-I-S-I, a branch of EMS, and was godfather to Di Cristina's son. Di Cristina was forced to resign by the Anti-Mafia Commission. His link to Ferzato was first discovered by the journalist Mauro De Mauro, M-A-U-R-O-D-E-M-A-U-R-O, who was kidnapped in 1970, allegedly while on the track of Mattei's killers. In February of 1975, Ferzato's receipt of kickbacks from banks controlled by Michele Sindona became public, and he was forced to resign from EMS. Indicted for fraud soon thereafter, he fled to Beirut. He has been the target of assassination attempts, apparently by Di Cristina's gang, which feared he would testify about Di Cristina's siphoning off of EMS deposits with Sindona. And then he cites a couple of sources, including Luigi DiFonso, St. Peter's banker, which we dealt with at great length in Radio Free America 17 through 21. And of Salvatore Lima, the Italian Christian Democratic leader, Marshall writes as follows. Lima began his public career as organizer of sports and games for the DC, that's the Christian Democratic Party, in Palermo. He became mayor of the Sicilian capital in 1958. During his first 4 years in office, 80% of all building contracts went to frontmen for mafia leader Angelo La Barbera, B-A-R-B-E-R-A, later killed by Buscetta, who ensured Lima's election and handled his security. In 1967, he became deputy secretary of the D.C. for Sicily. And of the Black Prince, so-called, Agliata de Monterreale, Marshall writes, born in Rio de Janeiro in 1921, the Sicilian mason Giovanni Francesco Agliata di Monterreale was a monarchist, dropped from the army in 1946 for refusing to swear loyalty to the Republic. One of his allies during these days of monarchist agitation was the American Admiral Ellery Stone, head of the Allied Control Commission in Italy, who hailed from IT&T. It was Stone who directed James Angleton, then of OSS, to rescue fascist Decima Mas leader Prince Valerio Borghese from a death sentence ordered by the partisans. That's Decima Mas was a fascist organization in immediate post-World War II Italy, headed up by Prince Borghese, who we dealt with at great length in our five-part series about Italian and Vatican politics. In 1970, Borghese would attempt to overthrow Italian democracy, allegedly with U.S. support. And by the way, that support was more than alleged. The Pike Committee, investigating CIA misdeeds, disclosed that Michele Sindona, the aforementioned P2 banker, was the conduit for CIA funds channeled to the so-called strategy of tension terrorist attacks, including the aforementioned Fiumicino Airport massacre, and that was aided by a man named Fiorenzi, Roberto Fiorenzi, another of Stark's intimates in Italy. Continuing with a footnote. Another ally was Edgardo Sogno, S-O-G-N-O, whose Pace a Libertà was CIA-funded, who, like Aliata, would later be linked to the Rose de Vente coup plots against the Italian government. In 1974, an arrest warrant was issued against Aliata for political conspiracy. Note the role of fiat money in these plots, a link to Libya. Interrupting once again, the Rose de Vente coup group involving, among others, Vito Micheli and Michele Sindona was assisted not only by Borghese, but also was receiving arms from Otto Skorzeny. We talked about that in RFA number 19. Continuing, Aliata was elected to Parliament in 1948 after helping to mastermind the massacre of leftist peasants by mafia-backed Sicilian bandit Salvatore Giuliano. He stayed in Parliament until 1960. In later years, he was a member of the PSDI. In the late 1960s, he frequented Malta and Libya. He was tied through Antonio De Angelis to the pro-Deo movement of Andrew Felix Morlion, M-O-R-L-I-O-N, widely regarded as having CIA and CIFAR ties. CIFAR was an Italian intelligence service. Aliata was a leader in the Grand Lodge of Italy, Piazza del Gesù, reborn 1952, along with Francesco Bellantonio, B-E-L-L-A-N-T-O-N-I-O, brother-in-law of P2 member and Rose de Venti plotter, Michele Sindona. With help from Frank Gigliotti, G-I-G-L-I-O-T-T-I, X-O-S-S, Generoso Pope, and other CIA-connected U.S. Masons, Aliazza reunified his Black Lodge with the Grand Orient of Italy, Palazzo Giustiniani, and then the sources, all of them Italian, are cited by Marshall. It's worth noting, too, that the connections here of De Monterreale to Andre Felix Morlian are interesting. This is a network of associations. We looked at Morlian as being a probable contributor, key contributor to the so-called Bulgarian thesis through the information he apparently provided to Italian and P2 secret service officials concerning the apartment of Mr. Antonovich, the alleged Bulgarian participant in the plot against the Pope. And finally, the last of the Stark associates footnoted by Marshall, the aforementioned Vito Michelli, Marshall writes as follows. Michelli had particularly close ties with the Arab world through his interests in securing Italy's oil supplies. Michelli had particularly close ties with the Arab world through his interest in securing Italy's oil supplies. He developed contacts with Saudi sheiks, Yasser Arafat, and above all, Muammar Gaddafi, whose life he saved. Michelli was also close to the American embassy, which passed him $800,000 in February of 1972. He used the money to finance a huge right-wing propaganda campaign, apparently spearheaded by the neo-fascist journalist Giorgio Torchia, T-O-R-C-H-I-A. That was hardly a new tack for Michelli, a member of the P2 Lodge. He aided the famous Prince Borghese coup plot of December 8, 1970. He was also, beginning in 1972, an organizer of the Rose de Venti conspiracy, along with Michele Sindona, his longtime friend. So, the thing that's intriguing here is that we find Ronald Hadley Stark up to his eyeballs with the very milieu that we examined in our Mediterranean merry-go-round series. Thomas Angeletti, Borghese, Vito Michelli et al. And the reason that we're reading the footnotes here and the detail that Marshall provides about these associates, we don't want to damn anybody by association. But on the other hand, when someone spends all of their time associating with Italian fascists, U.S. intelligence officers, coup plotters, and so forth, it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that he was of like mind.
All right, continuing with the description not only of who the people that Stark associated with, but the kinds of things that they were involved in. Through Verzotto, Stark apparently also knew Bernardino Andreola, ex-commando in Decima Mas, Prince Borghese's diehard fascist squad formed near the end of World War II, who tried to infiltrate Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli's nascent left terrorist group in 1968 to 1969. These figures have in common roots in a Sicilian, mafia, fascist, P2, Masonic, and Libyan milieu. Note that Gaddafi was a strong financial backer of fascist causes in the early 1970s, and also of Sicilian separatist movements, such as those advanced by banker Michele Sindona and Michele Papa, later of Billy Carter fame. Arrested with Stark were the engineer Fiorenzi and one Franco Buda, who, fearing he would be implicated in something too big, informed the instructing judge of Stark's and Fiorenzi's ties to the perpetrators of the notorious Fiumicino airport massacre. Buda said that Fiorenzi had safe-housed at his villa in Siracusa one of the organizers of the plot, at the request of a Sicilian who held a high post in the armed forces, raising suspicions that General Vito Michelli himself had been responsible. Fiorenzi's name has also come up in connection with the neo-fascist Italicus train bombing. In his own interrogation, meanwhile, Stark claimed to be Kuri Ali, a Palestinian. He carried a perfect Lebanese passport. Only later did he reveal his true identity. He also went by the alias Terence William Abbott. Stark said he was part of a powerful international terrorist organization called Group 14, with its headquarters in Lebanon. In prison in Pisa, on drug charges, Stark befriended two top leaders of the Red Brigades, Renato Curzio and Roberto Franceschini, who had worked for Radio Prague. He seems to have been housed near them shortly after several functionaries from the anti-terrorist agency, DIGOS, D-I-G-O-S, visited him in prison. The Red Brigade's leaders took Stark into their confidence, while Stark in turn was informing to Italian authorities. In April 1976, he revealed to the chief prosecutor of Pisa, Giotto Ladu, that he learned from Renato Curzio of plans to kill Judge Francesco...
Coco,
that's right, of course, yes. Judge Francesco Coco and to kidnap a leading Roman politician. The information wasn't passed on. Coco was killed in Genoa on June 8 by the brigades. Aldo Moro may well have been the other victim.
Continuing. Transferred to a jail in Bologna, Stark gained the confidence of Enrico Paghera, P-A-G-H-E-R-A, a leader of Azione Revoluzionario, a left anarchist terrorist organization heavily composed of foreigners. Red Brigade's leaders had encouraged Paghera to get in touch with the American, whom they knew as a Palestinian. Stark impressed Paghera with his extraordinary intelligence, confidence, money, and contacts. Among those contacts were Libyan embassy representatives in London and Rome, some of whom would visit his cell in Bologna. One of them brought Stark a new passport. "You don't imagine I'll be here for long, do you?" Stark told Paghera. Stark helped Paghera escape from prison by conspiring with a prison warden to fake a medical emergency for Paghera's mother. The aim, Stark said, was to lock the Italian up with an international terrorist organization that would attack embassies. Stark had claimed to be a business representative of the most powerful person in Lebanon, one who has 60,000 men at his command. The figure in Acid Dreams, by the way, was 6,000. This leader was the Shiite head of Al-Amal, the Imam Musa Sadr, that's M-O-U-S-S-A-S-A-D-R, who disappeared at the end of August 1978 on a flight from Tripoli to Rome, apparently in an operation ordered by the Libyan Secret Service. The Imam controlled a military camp a few kilometers from Baalbek, where Stark directed Paghera to go. Stark had instructed Paghera also to contact, quote, the director of M. Saudi Banca Nazionale Tripoli, Libya. He was, in fact, president of the Libyan Arab Foreign Bank, which holds about 10% of fiat stock for Gaddafi. Let me read that last sentence again. The Imam controlled a military camp a few kilometers from Baalbek, where Stark directed Paghera to go. Stark had instructed Paghera also to contact, quote, the director of M. Saudi, Banco Nazionale Tripoli, Libya. He was, in fact, president of the Libyan Arab Foreign Bank, which holds about 10% of fiat stock for Gaddafi. Paghera was arrested in Lucca on the 19th of April, 1978, less than a month after Aldo Moro's kidnapping with four other terrorists, the Calabrian Pasquale Vocaturo, V-O-C-A-T-U-R-O, the Roman Renata Bruschi, B-R-U-S-C-H-I, the Spaniard Luis José Cuello, C-U-E-L-L-O, and the Chilean Ernesto Reyes Castro. This led to new terrorism charges against Stark, from whom the Bologna magistrate... parts of this essay are sort of obscured. The printing isn't the best. This led to new terrorism charges against Stark from the Bologna magistrate on 11th of October, 1978. Finally, Stark also befriended, while in jail, Maurice Bignami, B-I-G-N-A-M-I, who went into hiding in September of 1970 after working in the same office with two others accused of ties to Prima Linea. Bignami has all sorts of terrorist connections, including to Tony Negi, N-E-G-I, and his Autonomia Organizzata. Thus, Stark, in a sense, united all three terrorist groups, BR, AR, and AO. Prima Linea, by the way, is another left-wing terrorist group in Italy. He united the aforementioned AO, that's Autonomia Organizzata, with the Red Brigades and Prima Linea.
Continuing. But was Stark all the while working for the CIA as an agent of infiltration? Throughout his prison stay, he received letters from various American diplomats. Charles Adams from the London Embassy addressed him as Dear Ron. He regularly received Wendy M. Hansen, a functionary of the American Consulate in Florence. And, though accused of crimes in the United States, his extradition was never requested. Stark, like American authorities, denied that he was a CIA agent. But he did tell the interrogating judge, "But do you, Your Honor, know what trouble will befall a CIA agent who admits it?" On June 26, 1978, the magistracy charged the head of DIGOS, D-I-G-O-S, in Bologna, Graziano Gori, to clarify Stark's ties to the U.S., Arabs, and other mysteries. But on July 4th, Gori died in an auto accident. Though originally condemned to 14 years in jail, a sentence later reduced to 8.5 years, Stark was set free on April 11th, 1979, by the instructing judge in Bologna, Giorgio Floridia. The judge based his decision on, quote, an impressive series of scrupulously enumerated proofs, unquote, that Stark was in fact a CIA agent. Besides the facts cited above, Stark reportedly also received money from Fort Lee, where the CIA allegedly operated, and possessed a British passport that was neither lost, stolen, nor counterfeit. Florida concluded that, quote, Stark, assigned from 1960 on to the American Secret Services, insinuated himself into the drug scene in the Middle East in order to infiltrate armed organizations, unquote, that were in contact with the, quote, European Terrorist Central. He fled on April 27th. The Bologna police speculated that he was clandestinely expatriated via a NATO airport in Pisa or Vicenza.
And skipping down in Marshall's essay, Stark's name surfaced again in 1982 in connection with a giant drug ring in which 65 Italians and foreigners were implicated. The ringleader was Dick Van Dyck, 38, of Holland, who organized the traffic of hashish, cocaine, and heroin between Europe and North Africa. One of his lieutenants was Guido Garelli, G-A-R-E-L-L-I, 38, the go-between for the Italian and Dutch gangs. He seems to have been a colonel in the security services of the former Spanish Sahara. According to the authorities, Garelli, now jailed, knows secrets about some of the most explosive events in Europe and the secrets of many police and intelligence organizations. The Italian press has linked him and his partner, Franco Buda, we talked about him above, a trafficker in stolen cars arrested in Spain, to Ronald Stark. Among the others implicated was the prosecutor general of King Hassan of Morocco, Ben Jiluni. Garelli concealed at his house in Algeciras the fascist terrorist Salvatore Francia, a leader of the Ordine Nuovo and a follower of Prince Borghese. Angelo Angeli, A-N-G-E-L-I, a leader of Squadra Il Azione Mussolini, who acquired 250 kilos of hashish and other wanted rightists. So again, reading that last sentence again as it's sort of complicated. Among the others implicated was the prosecutor general of King Hassan of Morocco, Ben Jiluni. Garelli concealed at his house in Algeciras the fascist terrorist Salvatore Francia, a leader of the Ordine Nuovo and a follower of Prince Borghese, Angelo Angeli, a leader of Squadra Il Azione Mussolini, who acquired 250 kilos of hashish and other wanted rightists. Stark ended up in a Dutch jail on charges of drug trafficking and illegally using a radio transmitter. Then he was quietly expelled to the United States, where he was granted bail in San Francisco prior to standing trial on the drug charges stemming from the 1973 Brotherhood of Eternal Love case. But Stark never did stand trial. The Justice Department, claiming that too many years had passed to prosecute the case, dropped charges in December of 1982, or maybe perhaps it's 83, it's cut off here. The whole matter was handled so discreetly that the press never caught wind of his return. So, again, the importance of this man is that he was not only the manufacturer for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, with all of their interesting connections to Tim Leary and William Allen Hitchcock, this fellow was the largest single supplier of underground LSD in history. And as I think one would say, certainly was an interesting fellow, and the chances of his not being a U.S. intelligence agent, I think, are absolutely remote. And again, note how far we've come from the notion of peace and love and some of the ideals expressed by the psychedelic counterculture. We find now that the trail winds up not only with arms trafficking, which the American end of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love was heavily involved in, but with the very same milieu which we looked at in our Mediterranean merry-go-round. And echoing the statement I made earlier in the broadcast, if that's your idea of peace and love, I'd hate to see your idea of war and hate.
Speaking of the scions of the LSD experience, one of the most important we discussed earlier in the broadcast was Timothy Leary. At the same time that Ron Stark was moving his laboratories around Europe and hobnobbing with the fat cats of the European fascist and intelligence milieu, Timothy Leary had gone to Algiers in Africa to hang out with Eldridge Cleaver and, among other things, proposed to Eldridge Cleaver the idea of putting on a series of radio broadcasts entitled none other than Radio Free America, interestingly enough. But at that time, the Cleaver had begun to split with the rest of the Black Panther Party, and for whatever reasons, he saw Timothy Leary as a negative influence. Of course, Cleaver himself later went through some rather interesting changes. And basically held Leary under house arrest for a while, and Leary was finally able to ante up enough money with some help from the Brotherhood of Eternal Love that Cleaver's Algerist Black Panthers would allow him to leave. So that's where we find Timothy Leary when we return to Acid Dreams by Martin Lee and Bruce Schlain. As they scrambled to get out of Algiers in early 1971, Tim and Rosemary Leary were aware of the gravity of their predicament. They had no legitimate travel papers, and additional advance money for Leary's book on his prison escape, titled Diaries of a Hope Fiend, was not forthcoming. Whoever could help them at this point became an instant ally. A British woman employed as a stringer for Newsweek introduced the Learys to a well-educated Algerian bureaucrat named Ali, who made no bones about his association with the CIA. Ali promised to arrange exit visas for them. Rosemary wondered if they could trust such a man. Quote, "He's liberal, CIA," Tim assured her, "and that's the best mafia you can deal with in the 20th century," unquote. The fugitive couple fled to Switzerland, hoping to obtain political asylum. Leary spent the first 6 weeks in jail while Swiss officials reviewed his case. Life behind bars was relatively pleasant, thanks to a mysterious benefactor named Michel Gustave Auchard, spelled H-A-U-C-H-A-R-D, who provided Leary with fine wine and assorted delicacies during his incarceration. Described by Leary as a tall, silver-haired gunrunner, Auchard had strong enough lines into the Swiss Council to secure Leary's release from prison. He also had the funds to bankroll Leary in the high style to which he had become accustomed. Leary nicknamed him Goldfinger, and accepted an invitation to stay in Lausanne at his luxury penthouse with an exquisite view of the lake.
So that's an interesting person for Tim Leary to have received assistance from while he was in prison. It's also interesting that he would make the comment about this fellow Ali, that he was liberal CIA, and that's the best mafia you can deal with in the 20th century. And again, bear in mind Ronald Hadley Stark, William Mellon Hitchcock, and the other intelligence connections to the Brotherhood of Eternal Love.
Remember earlier our talking about Mary Pinchot or Pinchot and her apparent death at the hands of the quote, liberal CIA wing at the very same time that she was having frequent contacts with Timothy Leary of the subject of LSD, and wonder where Timothy Leary got the idea that the liberal CIA was the best mafia that you could find to hang out with in the 20th century.
It's also worth noting that Philip Graham of the Washington Post was interned at Chestnut Lodge after beginning to become disenchanted with the Operation Mockingbird, the CIA's habit of using and recruiting journalists. And shortly after being Chestnut Lodge was where Dr. Frank Olson was incarcerated, described as a sort of a mental hospital for former CIA agents staffed by CIA people. And just after coming out of Chestnut Lodge, Philip Graham blew his brains out. And the lawyer for his estate was Edward Bennett Williams, who represented Richard Helms, who oversaw MKUltra. And it's an interesting series of associations worth noting here. Just as we see Ronald Hadley Stark intersecting so heavily with the Mediterranean merry-go-round, we see that Timothy Leary intersects rather heavily with some of the old-line Anglo-Saxon Protestants hooked up with the core, one could say, of the CIA, because now the CIA is a somewhat different organization than it was at the very beginning. An interesting thought, and something which is going to kick off the last part of our discussion concerning the CIA and LSD, was provided on the Brotherhood of Love by Henrik Kruger. This, of course, comes from The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger, subtitled Drugs, Intelligence, and International Fascism, published in softcover by the South End Press of Boston, copyright 1988, and incidentally edited by Jonathan Marshall. Of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, there's an interesting footnote in The Great Heroin Coup by Kruger. Somewhere among Robert Vesco's memorabilia floats the strange affair of the Brotherhood of Love. Through it, thousands of potential activists were stoned for years on LSD, and enormous profits from the sale of tablets were reinvested through the Investors Overseas Service-Controlled Fiduciary Trust Company. And the thing that's going to key at the last part of our discussion is that interesting comment by Kruger that through the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which as we've seen is heavily, heavily involved with the intelligence community. Where the intelligence community leaves off and it begins is, at least to a certain extent, sort of an academic distinction. And the question being here, if indeed the Brotherhood of Eternal Love was basically, at least in its later stages, an intelligence operation, and its massive intersection with the intelligence community, its involvement in the arms trade suggest that, what motivation would there be for such an activity on the part of CIA? Bear in mind the other critical ways in which the intelligence services generated the flow of LSD into American society.
One of the things that we've talked about before is the fact that during the end of the 1960s, and especially in the early 1970s, massive infiltration was going on throughout the, quote, protest movement in all its aspects, from the most hardcore to the Weather Underground, down to the relatively innocuous civil libertarian groups, the anti-war groups, and things of that nature. Now, one of the largest and most raging debates within these groups about their internal politics was the effect of drugs, especially LSD, on the will to political change. And there was a strong feeling among the more politically serious, as they consider themselves among these groups, that LSD was, in fact, a deterrent to political activity. So it was certainly something that, with the massive infiltration going on, was right in front of the agency all the time in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Reading some more from Acid Dreams, from a chapter appropriately titled What a Field Day for the Heat, from the old Buffalo Springfield song, talking again about what we have just been discussing, which is the role of LSD in terms of its effect on the political culture of the country. The use of LSD among young people in the U.S. reached a peak in the late 1960s, shortly after the CIA initiated a series of covert operations designed to disrupt, discredit, and neutralize the new left. Was this merely a historical coincidence, or did the agency actually take steps to promote the illicit acid trade? Not surprisingly, CIA spokesmen dismissed such a notion out of hand. Quote, "We do not target American citizens," former CIA Director Richard Helms told the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1971. Quote, "The nation must to a degree take it on faith that we who lead the CIA are honorable men devoted to the nation's service," unquote. I won't touch that one with a 10-foot stick. Helms' reassurances are hardly comforting in light of his own role as the prime instigator of Operation MK Ultra, which utilized unwitting Americans as guinea pigs for testing LSD and other mind-altering substances. During Helms' tenure as CIA director, the agency conducted a massive illegal domestic campaign against the anti-war movement and other dissident elements in the U.S. The new left was in a shambles when Helms retired from the agency in 1973. Most of the official records pertaining to the CIA's drug and mind control projects were summarily destroyed on orders from Helms shortly before his departure. The files were shredded, according to Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, chief of the CIA's technical service staff, because of, quote, "a burgeoning paper problem." Lost in the process were numerous documents concerning the operational employment of hallucinogenic drugs, including all existing copies of a classified CIA manual titled, quote, "LSD, Some Unpsychedelic Implications," unquote. What was Helms trying to hide? The wholesale destruction of these memoranda suggests there may have been a lot more to the CIA's LSD program than the revelations that came to light during the post-Watergate house cleaning of the mid-1970s. Of course, it's highly improbable that the CIA would ever have drawn up a, quote, "smoking gun" document describing the details of a plot to dump millions of hits of acid on the black market.
Reading again from Acid Dreams. An Italian parliamentary commission recently issued a lengthy report on domestic terrorism that included a section called The Case of Ronald Stark, unquote. The commission asserted that Stark was an adventurer who was used by the CIA. But proof as to exactly when his espionage exploits begin is hard to pin down. If Stark was connected to the CIA from 1960 on, as Judge Floridia suggested, then the entire Brotherhood operation, with its far-flung smuggling and financial networks, must be reinterpreted.
Continuing. It could have been that he was employed, quote, "it could have been that he was employed by an American intelligence agency that just wanted to see more psychedelic drugs on the street," Scully acknowledged. "Then again, he might have tricked the CIA just like he fooled everyone else," unquote.
That should be taken with a grain of salt.
Yes. Reflecting upon the 60s, a surprising number of counterculture veterans endorsed the notion that the CIA disseminated street acid en masse so as to deflate the political potency of the youth rebellion. Quote, "LSD makes people less competent," contends William Burroughs. "You can see their motivation for turning people on. Very often it's not necessary to give it more than just a little push. Make it available, and the news media takes it up, and there it is. They don't have to stick their necks out very much." Burroughs was one of the first to suspect that the acid craze of the 1960s might have been a manipulated phenomenon. an opinion shared by John Sinclair, the former White Panther leader, who once sang the praises of LSD as a revolutionary drug. Quote, "It makes perfect sense to me," Sinclair stated. "We thought at the time that as a result of our LSD-inspired activities, great things would happen. And, of course, it didn't. They were up there moving that stuff around." I just cut that word. "Down on the street, nobody knew what was going on," unquote.
And again, bear in mind Henry Kruger's his rumination that thousands of potential activists were kept stoned on LSD. An interesting comment on the effects of LSD by the CIA is recalled here in Acid Dreams. As one CIA document instructed, quote, "Whatever reduces integrative capacity may serve to increase the possibility of an individual being overwhelmed by frustrations and conflicts hitherto managed successfully," unquote. So that essentially is something to mull over as we evaluate possibly why the CIA might have been interested in distributing LSD to its political opponents, in this case, elements of the anti-war movement and New Left.
Okay, now, another section from Acid Dreams. They're talking about the fact that when LSD was first introduced into the above-ground culture, in many places, specifically in Europe, that it was used as a form of therapy for basically aiding people with what they call psycho-exploration, with true psychiatric therapy. But then they're contrasting that with what happened in the United States and Canada, in North America. "A different approach," write Lee and Schlane, "a different approach caught on more quickly in Canada and the United States. Psychedelic therapy, developed by Captain Al Hubbard and popularized by Dr. Humphrey Osmond, was geared toward achieving a mystical or conversion experience. The procedure involved high dosages of LSD, precluding any possibility that the patient's ego defenses could withstand psychic dissolution." Now, that's a key phrase right there. "The procedure involving high dosages of LSD precluding any possibility that the patient's ego defenses could withstand psychic dissolution." Well, folks, I don't think anybody out there has to have psychic dissolution explained to them. This is not disillusion, but dissolution, meaning to dissolve the psyche.
And again, recalling the other CIA assessment of LSD, and bear in mind that Humphrey Osmond worked with some of the CIA's researchers. He was part of the CIA-funded and supervised LSD research project. Al Hubbard, of course, the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, a lifelong U.S. intelligence agent. And Barry repeating the phrase from the CIA document, "Whatever reduces integrative capacity may serve to increase the possibility of an individual being overwhelmed by frustrations and conflicts hitherto managed successfully." Something to think about as a possible motive for the CIA spreading this drug into society. Returning again to Timothy Leary, "The use of acid in a recreational context is a far cry from how the LSD pioneers of the 1950s, both the spies and the doctors, originally envisioned its future. It was Timothy Leary who first spoke of LSD in terms of hedonic engineering," unquote. "He promoted acid as a sacrament of play, the drug of homo ludens. The American people today are quantum jumps more sophisticated," Leary said recently, "about consciousness, about the nervous system, about self-actualization and self-indulgence, about pleasure being itself a reward. Pleasure is now the number one industry in this country. Recreational travel, entertainment, sensory indulgence. There's no question about that being number one. Now that was my goal." And again, once you think about Leary's comments and think about the notion of LSD inclining one toward mystical conversion and so forth, and ask yourself, and it's something we obviously don't have the answer to, but to what extent the CIA's field research on LSD led them to conclude that by promoting LSD use, it would propel a society in this direction, not only propelling people in the direction of mysticism and recalling our work on cults and mind control and the CIA's mind control program, specifically Radio Free America shows 6 and 7, and also thinking about the Reagan era, I guess one could say, the 80s, the me generation and the tendency of people, certainly people, I guess one could say that people have always been selfish, but with the enormous crises facing us in the world today and the preoccupation of so many of the so-called boomers with their BMWs or their trips to Club Med trips or what have you, again, I think it's worth asking ourselves to what extent the CIA's field research gave them the information that promoting the use of a drug like this would incline a social group in that direction.
One who has studied history, even one who hasn't studied history, is quite familiar with the idea that during the height of the sort of savage plutocracy of the Roman Empire, that the populace was kept entertained by, in the famous phrase, bread and circuses. So possibly what we're seeing here is the creative use of a rye bread fungus to help people to make their own mental circuses.
Before we finish up, Nip, let me change the cassette so that people can get this. For those people who eventually hear a rebroadcast or hear this on tape, this will be the last information on this side. We will conclude the broadcast on the next cassette side.
And we don't have much.